everybody. Welcome back to the Beyond the Peloton podcast. I'm Spencer Martin from the Beyond the Peloton newsletter. I'm here with Andrew Vance from the Choose the Hard Way podcast, the betterlab.io. Wears many hats, but today he is our co-host. Andrew, do you want to plug anything before we get going?
You can check out Choose the Hard Way everywhere you listen. It's the podcast about how hard things build stronger humans who have more fun. Had Heather Jackson on recently talking ultra running and going gravel. And I'm really excited. The next guest I have coming up is a world-renowned alpinist, photographer, filmmaker, and writer, Corey Richards, who I have wanted to have on the podcast for about 6 years. So I'm really excited about this interview. It'll be dropping in the next couple of weeks. And if you're interested in getting better sleep so that you can enjoy riding more, please check out thebetterlab.io.
But Andrew, I was just out with a few friends on a group ride in Boulder, Colorado. We did about, 180 miles. Did it at about 29 miles an hour. Did a few 9 watts per kilo, 5 minute efforts at the end. And, you know, I'd say if I had to talk about this ride, I'd describe it as the easiest thing I've ever done. And Of course, I'm referring to Tadej Pogačar talking about Milano Sanremo, which he didn't win at the end of the race said, and those are the real stats from it, 29 miles an hour for over 6 hours. And he described it as the easiest race or ride he's ever done in his life. Like, what is going on here? And then Fred Wright had a great comment. Why didn't he go faster on the Chipressa if it was so easy? Yeah. I don't know, Fred. That's a good idea. But Andrew, what? I don't know. I feel like I've gone over this. So I've done two separate newsletters on the race. People know my thoughts. What are your thoughts about the race?
The main thing that I'm thinking about in relation to the race is there another formula for winning it? Which I know that we've talked about this a little bit, but can you avoid the outcome that we saw, which is you either somehow snap the rubber band up the Poggio, which seems to be impossible if Pogačar cannot do it right now, being the best climber ever, probably with an incredibly explosive attack. If he can't snap the rubber band and drop everybody and get that gap, then how do you get a different outcome than either that the sneaky getaway on the descent, as we've seen Mohoric and other people do in recent history, or just chaos at the end and then negative racing yielding some kind of small group or a sprint finish? It seems like those are the only outcomes that you can possibly get in this race. Do you believe that there is some other strategy that could yield a different result on this parkour?
That's a good question. I mean, we should say first things first about Milano Sanremo. Used to be, I feel like, the duck of the monuments.
That was
like,
so boring.
The worst.
Yeah.
I think it's turning in. I don't know what is going on, but the modern racing, they do it an hour faster than they used to do. So the race is shrinking.
Bananas. Yeah.
And it's getting much better. I mean, because these, let's say Lombardy, Liège, in some respects, even Flanders, almost paint my numbers at this point. I know that's crazy to say, especially about Flanders. That's probably my favorite race of the year, but it's just strongest guy has a strategy, goes out, drops everyone on the hardest part of the course. He wins. There's like three riders that can win those races before. Sanremo is, because it's so easy, like almost tediously easy until you hit the final two climbs, which aren't that hard. It keeps the pool of winners high. It makes it so Pogačar can't just ride away. But they're also hard. It's the race is long enough that it's not just a bunch sprint. So it's almost turning into the perfect race, like the platonic ideal of a bike race. But I do think, so people can get away on the Poggio. If you go back to like 2018, Vincenzo Nibali just rides away on the Poggio, solos to the finish. Oddly, I went back and looked at that. They didn't go very fast up the Poggio. You know, they're going like almost 40 seconds slower than they did this year. So yeah, if they were going that slow, Pogačar could ride away and win. You know, what I think UAE meant to do was, you know, I don't know why they did this. They talked all week just about it. We're going to go sub-9 on the Sopressa, which is the second to last climb. Sub-9, everyone watch out. We're going sub-9, which would be fast, like the fastest time by, I think, 15 seconds of all time. And they get there. They're not even at the friggin' front of the race when they hit the bottom of the climb. Pogačar pulls a teammate up to the front with him, has him start pacing. The rest of the team's behind. So that guy's pacing, I bet, around 500 watts. So then the rest of the team has to move up to the front. You know, like the power they have to be doing to catch up to a guy pacing at that power level. They must have been shredded by the time they get to the front. they can't really do anything. You know, Tim Wellens helps, Del Toro helps for a little bit, but they get over the climb with just one guy left. You know, it's Tim Wellens and Pogacar. And I think the critical mistake is they needed to have everyone at the front on the Chipressa do a hard pace. Like, and ideally, Mark Hirschi is just on the front, rides as hard as he can up that climb. You tire everyone out, Mark Hirschi's gone, and you still have two or three riders left with you. And then the next guy goes as hard as he can on the descent and the flat, because what happened is with only Tim Wellens there, it got way too easy in between the final two climbs. Tom Pidcock took a piss. I've never seen anyone do that at like the critical point of a bike race like that. And so if he's pissing, it's not hard enough. And I think that's why the speed was so fast on the final climb, because at that level, those guys, if you give them 30 seconds to get their heart rates back down, they can do incredible efforts. It wasn't fast enough. Tim Wellens got back to the front on the Poggio. The Poggio was fast, I believe the fastest of all time. Pogacar rode it quite quickly, had a great attack. But I think what happened is it wasn't hard enough in between the climbs to then open up separation. But, you know, if they have a full fleet of team on the flat there, I think they could have made it hard enough for him to get separation and maybe stay away. The only problem is they go over the top, him and Vanderpool. Vanderpool, by the way, never looked stressed. I mean, that was
tranquil. Yeah.
A good day, but he just looked like he was nose breathing the whole time. Him and Pogacar off the front, and Tom Pidcock easily closed the gap on the descent. So that kind of makes me wonder, like, even if Pogacar, let's say he gets over the top with 6 seconds, which is enough to win, does he just get closed down by Tom Pidcock on that descent? You know, that's kind of what I'm wondering. Like, even if this goes perfectly, does he have a Pidcock closing in on him and out sprinting him? Which is, I guess, why it's such a hard race for him to win.
Yeah. And I mean, given the manner in which UAE entered that final climb, and maybe Pogacar just believed, I can still do this. Like, I'm going to pull a rabbit out of a hat. I'm still going to ride everyone off of my wheel. I just don't understand why he didn't sit third or fourth wheel, and maybe he thought that was his only possible chance of winning, and he was like, it's this or nothing. But it just seemed like a replay of last year. I just didn't see the point of sitting there and pulling everyone up for them to then win the race. But maybe in the moment he thought he was actually going to win.
Yeah, maybe he did, because he attacked, they caught up to him, and then he counterattacked. But if you go back and watch last year, Vanderpool got separation over the top.
Yeah.
But it's because he was sitting pretty far back, you know. And I think
that's what I'm saying. Yeah. Like, why didn't he sit back more? It's just like, good clearly question. the attack's coming. Okay. The closer that you get to the top, the more obvious it is that the attack is going to happen at some moment. There's no element of surprise. And then, as you noted, as soon as he goes, even though he gets a bit of a gap, we know that Vanderpool can, you know, he can do 1,000 watts for quite a long time, which we saw at the World Championships. He has like the best 1 minute power, maybe of anyone in the sport. So he's going to close that gap. And then you have Pidcock, fresh off of his his nature break, ready to, you know, do his Tuna Canyon gap close daredevil act. And there you go. Then the race is over. Another thought that I had was, when they got a close up of Ghana, I'm not liking GC Ghana. He's looking a bit too thin. I feel like he's lost everything. He can't sprint now. He can't climb with the best. And I'm sure we're going to see him suffering in time trials this year.
Yeah, well, he already got beat by Juan Ayuso on a flat time trial. But yeah, we didn't talk about this a few weeks ago. I wanted to talk about this. So yeah, GC Ghana, he's really skinny. I don't like it. I want my beefcake Ghana back. And he had a good ride. He actually currently has the Strava KOM on the Poggio only because Pogacar deleted his pre-ride, and he rode in his pre-ride. He got the KOM on the Poggio, rode 6 seconds faster than they did in the race. That's crazy. And you know, so he's climbing well. I think he had a mechanical on the descent, but as you say, like, I feel like if he wasn't on Ineos, he's Jonathan Milan. You know, he's a big sprinter. Like, him and Milan are teammates on the track and actually very similar riders. I feel like he could sprint almost as good as him.
Yeah, I actually have this in my notes. I wanted to talk about this a few weeks back, that Yeah, Jonathan Milan to me is Ganna 2.0. This is like the Ganna who wins races. Yeah.
And God, it just seems so tough for him to chase GC stuff. And I mean, that was a perfect example because he's not going to win the sprint. Jasper Philipsen won the race, by the way. I guess we should say that. Yeah. Philipsen, really fast sprinter, also really impressive. He got a little, he was kind of dangling a little bit, but he never looked under that much pressure. For a sprinter that good to be able to hold on that well, it's really impressive. If you go back to 2021, he actually hadn't won that much. I think he finished on the podium something like five or six times at that tour, just getting cleaned up by Mark Cavendish.
Right.
Since then, he's one of the best riders in the sport. 9 Grand Tour stage wins since 2022. No, since the end of 2021, which is ridiculous. And now he's won a monument and finished on the podium at Paris-Roubaix last year. The guy's seriously good. But Ganna's not going to beat Philipsen in a sprint at the end.
No.
So then you wonder, like, he would have to do a Mohoric attack or something like that on the flat, or like a Matteo Sobrero attack. And then he wasn't even doing that. Another kind of odd performance. Speaking of odd Italians, Alberto Bettiol. Like, where did that come from? The guy looked unshakable. And I looked it up. I don't think he'd finished in the top 10 of a monument since 2019. And he just looked like, yeah, I'm like one of the best riders in the world. Why wouldn't I be here? It's like, why haven't we seen this from you for years, Alberto?
Yeah. And then, of course, everyone was talking about Michael Matthews' glasses falling off of his face in the middle of the sprint, which had to be highly distracting. The thing that I thought when Michael Matthews got second was, where's Caleb Ewan?
Yeah.
Right. I think he's sick right now. He DNF'd Torino, but you have to remember he was second place at Milan San Remo in 2021. So
I think he was sick, which is why they didn't have him race. But also, Michael Matthews was sick before the race and they had him race. I mean, clearly, Ewan is on a little bit of a, what do they call, like probationary firefighters, probies. Like, I think Ewan might be a probie rider on Jayco, where he's on a probationary period currently.
Yeah.
They don't really trust him at the biggest races.
Yeah, this is pledship, I think, for Caleb. And pledship is a testing period. I'm going to stand by my statement I made maybe 2 months ago. I think, unfortunately, he's in for a Cavendish year, and not like a peak Cavendish year. This is a year when I think we're going to see him win one or two races. I think he's going to have a big 2025. I think he's got a rough year ahead. But I do think there's going to be a comeback. It's not going to be this year, though.
For Ewan.
Correct.
Yeah. I think it is a rough year. I do think there's something left in there. Michael Matthews has to be bummed about that. I mean, that's a good second place. Man,
but I mean, close. Come on.
That would have been the biggest win of his career. And he's getting up there in years. Like, I kind of forgot about him, to be honest with you. Like,
I had, yeah, he did get, didn't he win a tour stage like 2 years ago, unexpectedly, uphill sprint?
I think it was like the flowering of Van Aert. You remember, it was just like a beautiful first week of the tour where Pogacar was like, no, wait, got second a bunch of times behind Wout and Pogacar.
Yeah.
No, you're right. You're right. Stage 14.
Yeah.
So what happened is he was losing those sprints.
Yeah.
And then he went into the breakaway and like won an uphill finish.
That was unbelievable.
Yeah.
So he's the kind of rider who can do something spectacular he's 34, 33. Right. I'm sorry. He's 33. So basically he's like in a senior center at this point in the peloton.
Years old.
Yeah.
And he must be improving. I mean, that's the most impressive thing to me, because these guys are so good.
Right.
Like Pate, even like Mats Pedersen, that he has to be improving into his 30s to even be finishing second at this race. So I was really impressed with that. Let's just have a little bit of story time here, a little number of story time. So if you
let's do it.
Like, wow, I could do the Poggio. What is that? It's like 4K or 2K. No, 4K, 4%, easy, right? And a podcaster did it and was like, yeah, it's not that hard, but I guess maybe it's hard at the end of a long race. It's like, no, you're forgetting an important part of the equation. They do it at about 600 watts for 5 minutes. That's the hard part. It's not just getting up and over it. But Pogacar, the KOM time was 5:25. The time they did in the race was about 5:31. So that's 1650 VAM, and that's a high VAM, vertical meters gained per hour, for a not steep climb. That's really high. I have a little calculator I can punch into. And, you know, this probably, I tried to take into account what the drafting benefit would be, but, you know, he wasn't getting a ton of drafting benefit because he was so far up there. Probably did over 500 watts, like let's say 550 watts for 5.5 minutes. At his weight, that's about 9 watts per kilo at the end of a 6-hour race. That's unbelievable. And then for Ghana to be there, you know, the guy's pushing 80 kilos. That means he was probably averaging between 600 and 700 watts for over 5 minutes just to be in that group, which is really, really impressive. Like, just go out and try to hold that for 5 minutes after you listen to the show today. And I don't think you'll be able to. You'll find that difficult.
Well, Ghana must have eaten his ice chips before this race. That's all I can say.
And another, like, I don't know what's going on, but I don't even know how much I should share. But Johan Bernil, my coworker at a different place, already shared this a little bit on the move, but there's been a bit of scoopage going on, maybe some leakage out of the UAE camp, and potential Training Peaks numbers have been shared from Tadej Pogacar that perhaps shouldn't have been shared. But I think everyone knows by now that Iñigo San Millán is no longer his coach. He's working with this guy, Javier Solor, who is like kind of more of a stereotypical cycling coach, like someone who knows about cycling, who's done it at a high level and coaches it for a living, versus San Millán, who is a cancer researcher for his living, which always, I mean, obviously a smart guy if he's doing that, but always kind of struck me a bit odd. Like, just because you're, you know, what if I was a professional basketball player and I'm like, yeah, I have a guy who helps me with my shot selection and he's a partner at a law firm. You'd be like, well, wait, what? Like, what's his domain expertise? Oh, he played some D3 college basketball. I think he's got it under control. But San Millán, I think everyone knows, is like big into zone two, which is good. You know, he's having these guys train at massive volumes at
zone two, make some noise.
And it's clearly working. But Pogacar left. I had, you know, someone reach out in the know who said that, you know, potentially this overindulgence in zone two is there's a theory within the team. That's why guys are stagnating. Like, think of Joao Almeida, like never really been better than he was his first year as a big pro. And he often has trouble closing gaps. You know, he'll be, you know, for 40 minutes, he'll be 5 seconds behind a group. He can't push up into that VO2 area to close gaps. Same thing with like Juan Ayuso. Like, he's never been better than he was at 19 years old, which is a little bit of a red flag. Like, you should be improving from after 19. Like, that's when he got the best result of his career, third at the Vuelta. So, you know, I think there's some uneasiness in the team about San Milan's training. And this person's theory was that Pogacar is just so good. He could even, like, you and me could be coaching him and it'd be second at the tour because his ceiling or his floor is so high. But he switched over to a different coach. I mean, I think he looks better, looks more explosive. So we'll see how that is at the tour. Apparently, his FTP right now is 431 watts, and that's at 65 kilos. So that's 6.6 watts per kilo right now, this part of the year. He wants to be 63 kilos at the tour. You know, that could push his FTP up close to 7 watts per kilo. And that's what, like, Lance Armstrong before the tour would want to be at 7 watts per kilo. Interesting, Lance said at this time of year, he'd be about 5.5 watts per kilo. So Tadej is much, much better than Armstrong would be at this time of year. Like, I would love to dig in sometime with a professional about why these guys, is there a benefit of being so good right now if you're trying to win the tour, or should you just lance it where you're just kind of like a Geraint Thomas, you know, build and you just build for one race of the year.
2 weeks in the bar.
2 weeks in the bar, baby. But that gives you the energy in July.
Yeah, I mean, maybe it works for him.
But the team did a 30-kilometer flat time trial, UAE, in February at the training camp. You know, Mikael Berg, really good time trialist, 33 minutes, 58 seconds. And I got this, I just stole this from Johan Bernil, so I want to credit him. Juan Ayuso, 33 minutes, 40 seconds. Tadej Pogacar, and Juan Ayuso just beat Filippo Ganna in a flat time trial. Tadej Pogacar, 32 minutes, 44 seconds. So the guy is absolutely flying right now. I don't want to like contribute to the hysteria that he maybe can win the tour this year, but I do think he is probably better this year in a grand tour sense than he was in years past. And just to give you a little taste for his training rides, He likes to go out for, let's say, four and a half hours at 5 watts per kilo, which if we do a little bit of math, that is just a cool 325 watts for 4 hours. And then he likes to polish that off with a few 7.5 watts per kilo intervals, 490 watts for 15 minutes at the end of that. So just go out and do that today and just do that every day for about 3 months and you'll be right and ready for the Tour de France.
Well, that sounds like this wild new concept we've been reading about called repeatability, where people are training to actually be strong at the end of a ride and not just when they pull out of the Trader Joe's parking lot in South Pasadena on the Montrose ride down there in SoCal. So Spencer, I know you probably can't say much about the source of this information, aka Watt's throat. but is this like a Watt's leak situation? You know, are there only a handful of people who have this gigantic treasure trove of data from UAE, or what's going on?
It's not clear.
Okay.
It's not clear. And I don't know. I have theories about what's going on, but I almost don't want to share. But but I wouldn't have shared this, but Johan already shared a little bit on the move. I thought it was pretty interesting. It's riveting stuff when I heard it.
It is riveting stuff. It's out there in the public domain now, so it's definitely worth talking about. And insofar as Pogacar has moved on from Iñigo, Sam Alon is now with Javier Soler. I do have to ask, has Soler been on Peter Attia's podcast? Can we trust this man?
Yeah, can we? Exactly. How do we know he knows what he's talking about? If he's not, I actually don't see him on any Joe Rogan or Peter Attia podcast.
Okay.
So it's unclear. Does this man know anything about cycling or fitness? Potentially not. I love Patrick Bro, the Lantern Rouge podcast host. His hottest take recently is Peter Attia not fit, because what is his FTP? What is his 5K time running? Like, if it's not fast, Patrick's not impressed. And so
I don't know. I know that someone who you work with or associated with does spend some time, I think, walking around with weighted backpacks with Peter Attia. So maybe we could find out. I have seen Peter Attia on a trainer on social media or on YouTube. So he definitely rides bikes. So I think it would be possible for us to potentially find out what his FTP is. So maybe we can work our sources on this one.
I would love actually to go on a ride with him in Austin sometime. I mean, I Peter Attia, you know, we're obviously kind of making fun of the fact that Zone 2, people are acting like Zone 2 is something that they just discovered last week. But in general, Piatia's advice is quite good, you know, about like how to live life and stay healthy and stay mobile. So
I don't walk it back, Spencer. But yeah,
Peter Attia. I wouldn't want Peter Attia training Jonas Vingegaard, though. I think there's a line there.
Yeah, if you happen to be listening, Peter Attia, the door is open. We're happy to ride with you. We'd come to Austin. You can come to us. You want to come to Midcoast, Maine? We'll show you how it's done up here, my friend. Yeah, so Spencer, just going back to Milan San Remo for a second, and Philipsen taking the win, devastating Matthews, who was left to go cry into his pile of jewelry, his nickname, of course, being Bling. I'm thinking at this point, is Alpecin De Koninck dollar for dollar like the highest value team in the peloton? And is what they've done over the past 5 years, the Rudhoofd?
Brothers.
Brothers. It's seeming pretty genius at this point, because it used to seem like this was just this ragtag team put together to enable Matthew Vanderpool getting to ride across a bunch of different disciplines. And like, so he could just like show up and go to road races. Before that, they had a bit of that, you know, stormtroopers in the background kind of vibe. Mm-hmm. But I mean, at this point, this strategy of not having a GC rider on the team, or if they have one, I'm not seeing it, but just like going into races just to win stages or to focus on the monuments, it seems pretty genius at this point, and it really seems to be working.
These brothers are playing chess. Everyone else is playing checkers. I mean, they're so smart, and they're smart, but they're also just very disciplined. I think in life and in sport and in business, just knowing who you are and being comfortable with that and focusing on that is really important, but not a lot of people have the confidence to do that. Like, they know exactly who they are, and they don't, I think as you said last week, they don't go chasing waterfalls. They stick to the rivers and streams that they're used to. You know, they had Jay Vine on their team They went from the second division to the first division. I remember Benji Nossen vividly. I remember him saying this on a podcast, like, oh, they have to then go get GC riders. But it's, I remember thinking, why? Like, why do they need to do that? Just don't do the GC thing. You can rack up enough points anyway to secure your world tour status. If you actually can probably get more points not having GC riders and not spending money on them, because they're so expensive. Not only the riders, but the domestiques. You're going to have to pay seven figures to have decent climbing domestiques. So they just let Jayvine go to UAE. They reinvested the money they would have spent on him on more bigger, you know, they fish where the fish are. Like, they're in Belgium and they have an endless, I guess, like lazy Susan of big, strong riders coming along who can win monuments if they need to, especially with the help of Matthew Vanderpool. And they focused on that. And they are pound, like dollar for dollar, they're the best performing team in the sport by far. They have five monument wins, I believe, since 2020, which is a lot. That's a lot for a team, especially at that budget.
Yeah. And now Vanderpool has signed this 10-year agreement with Canyon. The Roodhoofd brothers and the team also seem to be part of the, it's okay, it's a separate deal. They're going to extend their relationship with Alps and De Koninck. I mean, number one, I'm suspecting that given Vanderpool is doing a 10-year deal, so he's going to finish his career on a Canyon. And I'm assuming, or my guess would be, that he's getting equity in the company as part of this deal and a cash payment. So he's going to benefit as the brand grows, similar to relationships we've seen other athletes have with brands, such as Patrick Mahomes. Pardon me, I'm choking up talking about it.
Yeah, tears in your eyes thinking about that overtime win.
Yeah, absolutely. But yeah, like Patrick Mahomes, LeBron James, their relationship with Whoop, they were, you know, they got equity. They were also investors in addition to being sponsored athletes who would go out and do marketing on behalf of the company. So I'm wondering if that's part of what's going on here. But it seems like, you know, we're going to see the core of this team probably be together for a long time. Going back to your point that the Roodhoofd brothers are playing at a higher level here, I think both on the sporting side and on the business side, they're definitely thinking very long term, and this is going to be a relationship that is going to be around for a while.
Yeah, and as you say, the team, I used to think of it as, well, like, this is kind of a joke team. Why is Vanderpool even on this? It just is a vehicle for him to race cross, mountain bike, and road, whatever. Let's get to a real team, buddy. And I thought he was taking a big pay cut to be on the team, but this probably solves that because he gets his salary from the team, which I'm sure is decent. And then Canyon covers the rest and probably makes him one of the highest paid riders in the sport. And I mean, I don't know how much we want to wade into this, but there's allegedly a salary cap coming in 2026.
Yeah.
I hate to spoil it, but that's not going to happen. And let's just say that did happen. That would be exempt, I guess, because if the team's not paying him, it's the bike sponsor paying him. You know, who's to say that Vanderpool can't go out and strike a deal with Deloitte and they pay him $5 million a year just to be an ambassador? Like, if that's not coming out of the team budget. So they've kind of future-proofed themselves against any impending salary cap by having Canyon pay him instead of the team pay him. One more thing on San Remo.
Sorry, but perhaps Red Bull has done that as well with their individual athletes that are going to end up on the Red Bull Bora team. So maybe we're starting to see a pattern here.
Yes. And does the Red Bull thing make any freaking sense? So this team is going to be called Red Bull. and they've fooled me. I did real reporting on this and I was asking around and they said, no, like, we're going to be Bora Hansgrohe. And they assured me. And then no, now Red Bull's coming in. And there was actually a little loophole I was unaware of, that you can have three title sponsors, which seems crazy, but they'll be Red Bull, Bora, Hansgrohe. Sorry, Hansgrohe, no one's going to say the last one, but I'm sure they're happy because the team is much more high profile now than it was before. So they'll benefit by proxy. So you're going to have a team called Red Bull, owned by Red Bull. And then you have riders on other teams with Red Bull helmets paid by Red Bull. So let's say Roglic needs a little bit of help at the tour. Apologies if we've talked about this on the show before, but let's say Roglic needs a little bit of help at the tour. What's to stop Red Bull from going to Tom Pidcock and Wout Van Aert and saying, hey guys, we need a little bit of help over here and we pay your salary, so let's work for us. And then having collusion between riders on other teams, but under the same umbrella of the sponsor. Like, I don't, And it's even just going to look weird if Tom Pidcock has a Red Bull helmet and then there's another team in the race with Red Bull jerseys, but they're not affiliated in any way. I don't get how that's going to work at all.
Yeah, I don't really get how it's going to work either. And as I think about this Vanderpool, his deal with Canyon, and then I think about Wout. I'm just getting a little choked up right now, Spencer. Sorry, I don't know what's going on.
Those Canyon bikes.
Yeah, no, I'm thinking about Wout and his deal with Red Bull and then how he's kind of slotted into this role, which I think as we saw in the Unchained series, you know, he's maybe not getting to do everything that he actually wants to do on that team. I think that's pretty fair to say, right? Like he's having to ride in support of other riders at times when he absolutely does not want to. Whereas we're seeing Vanderpool, the genuine vibe that I get, like what we saw at Milan San Remo, I think he was actually like quite happy that Philipson won and it wasn't like a weird vibe, right? So I'm just wondering if by Wout going into more of this GC team setting, we all know we're going to see GC Wout coming out of the gate here in, you know, less than 40 days. Like we're going to see him, I think, become GC Wout, pulling a bit of a Ghana in a way. Like he's starting to drift from what he's truly great at, and maybe that's what he wants. Maybe he's like, I want to show that I can be a GC rider. But would it have benefited him more to stay on the path of this is what I'm great at and I'm going to do more of it, which is really what Vanderpool has done.
Yeah, and it goes back to that point when I didn't quite understand why Vanderpool is on that team. But by staying with the team, he's kind of write his own destiny a little bit more.
Yeah,
because I do kind of worry about, I mean, clearly we're seeing something happening with Wout where he's not going to the tour. He's doing the Giro, skipping the tour. I think that maybe is him saying, I don't just want to be a domestique anymore. This doesn't make a ton of sense for me. Because as you say, there was some clear tension in the Unchained documentary. I'm curious to see what it's like in the second season. The Vanderpool stuff is interesting because he didn't flinch at all. They clearly had a plan. And if Christoph Rudhoof was my manager, I wouldn't flinch at all either. I would listen to whatever he said because he is a very serious, kind of intimidating guy. So maybe that's what's going on here. But he was just so focused on that. He didn't react, didn't pull with Pogacar, just stayed there, welded the race together. Philipson wins. In retrospect, does that make any sense? Let's say he does that. Let's say Matthew's glasses don't fall off. He wins the bike throw. It's like, well, that was a little silly to weld the race back together so Matthews could win. Should he have just attacked with Matej Modric? And then he's doing a reverse lead out where he's up front. Everyone else has to pull Philipson behind or just let Vanderpool ride to the line with Mohoric, which I assume he wins that sprint. I mean, maybe they'd be concerned that then Pogacar jumps across and then Pogacar, I mean, that sprint at the end of the race was really impressive. Those are two fast sprinters, and he was not really losing ground to them. So I guess in theory, if he goes to the line with Pogacar, Vanderpool loses that sprint, and they would have thought, well, we just should have gone all in for Philipson because he's one of the fastest sprinters in the world, and maybe we just ride that horse. But I did kind of wonder at the time, like, why is he just welding this back together with Matthews in the group instead of trying to go out front, force everyone else to pull him back, and he tries to win. But maybe Vanderpool's, he's been there, done that. I don't need to win another San Remo. I already won one.
Well, yeah, and we haven't seen Wout since February 25th when he won Kern-Brussel-Kern. I'm assuming he's on the volcano right now, right?
Wout is volcanoing. He races on Friday, though. So
okay.
In Belgium. So he might be coming down.
Yeah, he's descending from the heavens to race in Belgium. And then I bet he'll go right back to the volcano. But yeah.
Well, I bet he stays there. And I think he races again on Sunday. No, he doesn't race on Sunday. But he races like on Wednesday. And then races next. And then that next Saturday at Flanders. So he might be in Belgium from there forward.
Okay. So, but he's had a brief volcano period to get ramped up for this. Just another observation about Milan-San Remo. So we know fastest Milan-San Remo ever. And this is the year that canted brifters have pretty much been banned. So what does that say about the efficacy of canted brifters if we're having the fastest race speed ever and no one can turn their brifters in until they touch in the middle?
It's definitely a damning... It's damning evidence for the canter brifters. I didn't think about this. This is such a good take. clear. I do think they had a tailwind, which probably helped the fast time. But yeah, the canted brifters don't seem to be missed. I was noticing today tons of crashes. It doesn't seem like the crashes have really stopped, but who's to say? Maybe too early to draw a conclusion.
All right. Did Taco Vanderhorn retire because his pro cycling stat?
Yeah, well,
like what's going on? I feel dug into right this. Now. Where is Taco?
It's not good. I totally missed this. So his last race was a year ago. It was 2023 Tour of Flanders.
Yeah.
Apparently he crashed. It's one of these like crash concussion. You read it, you leave it. Clearly some sort of TBI though. If he hasn't raced, he can't really train at full speed a year later. That's probably not good.
That's really sad. I know I've talked about Taco a lot in the past 24 months. I really valued what he brought to the sport. He was an innovator. He was often off the front, and he was finding ways to win with what he had, which I really appreciated. So that's a bummer. I didn't know that.
Really, really a bummer. I mean, I was actually surprised how... Did you see this breakaway? Made it over the Tripressa at San Remo, and then Davide Bias attacks again. You're like, man, like if Vanderhorn was in that group, like did they
go to someday, the line.
Someday I do think we'll see someone get over the Poggio. We'll see a breakaway get over the Poggio. And then you have an early breakaway winning at San Remo. I do think that's possible. So add that to the tally of how the race could be won. Last bit, and this is just bait. We're just having fun here. But the hug gate, I think it needs to be discussed. There, everyone's hugging at the end. So first, Vanderpool comes in, gives Phillips a hug. You're like, well, they're teammates. That makes a lot of sense. Then you see someone that looks like a family member of Phillips, and he's so excited, just hugging, kissing the man. It's Tadej Pogacar. What's going on here? And then Michael Matthews also in the hug fest, I believe. And it gets even worse. Did you know that Michael Matthews gave Tadej Pogacar a ride to the start of the race? Like they are best friends, like the best of friends. To give a man a ride to a race, you have to be very close. This is upsetting to a lot of people, to a lot of former competitors. And what's funny is this is also happening in, like, let's say American sports, not so much football because they go out there and like literally try to kill each other, but basketball, everyone's friendly with each other, you know, and it really... The old-time players get really upset about it, and fans also get upset about it. I mean, it's funny that in cycling, it doesn't really seem, at least English-speaking land, fans don't seem to be bothered by it. What's your take on this hugging? Is the hugging good? Is it bad? Do we need to stop it?
Yeah, I was thinking about this when I was on the trainer today, struggling to put out 4.8 watts per kilo for a minute at a time, doing some intervals. And the thing that sprang to mind for me is people who are fans of combat sports, if they remember the early days of the UFC or Pride, the Japanese mixed martial arts organization that the UFC eventually bought, that was very popular at the turn of the millennium. You know, in Pride, it was legal to do a lot of things that are now banned. Like you could soccer kick downed opponents in the head, for example. And there are a lot of people who really like that. And there are people who think that the sport's a bit diluted now, that certain actions are not allowed. And what I think ultimately is people can have whatever opinions they might have about Huggate. And if you want to truly shape the behaviors that are happening at the end of races, then get on a bike and figure out how to put out 9 watts per kilo, and then you can be there and you can have a say in this debate.
I won't hug him, and I'm not going to hug.
Yeah, winner. Yeah, totally.
I got a little triggered, I will admit, and I started to catastrophize in my mind. I'm like, we are one step away from Pogacar. Let's just say Pogacar and Matthews are away from him just gifting him a victory, like Wout gifted Laporte the win at Gent-Wevelgem last year, which they were teammates. So
I didn't like it at all. Strong dislike.
But imagine if they were not teammates. I would spontaneously combust. I would be so upset. So that's where my mind went. I'm like, we are dangerously close to just Pogacar giving away wins. But then I came back to reality. I mean, Pogacar race is hard. The guy is a competitor. Like, he doesn't want those guys to win. Like, this is not affecting the competitiveness of the races at all. So it's kind of a non-issue. And I actually, maybe I'm a psycho, but I race harder. I compete harder against friends than people I don't know as well. You know, like if the hardest I've ever suffered are like on the wheels of friends, just trying not to get dropped, or like chasing someone down, closing down a gap to win the bus stop against a friend.
Probably a BWR Kansas 2023. I think that's when you went deepest to beat me, Spencer.
Yeah, I mean, if you hadn't have gone up the road, I actually think I might have been like, I'll let that group go. I think that's fine.
Totally. I mean, that's what's fun about racing bikes with your friends. I agree with
you. Yeah, so I think it's fine because it's not, if anything, it's just making it more competitive. Because the guy who doesn't really participate in this is Jonas Vindigo. Like, you notice after every race he's just on the phone calling his wife, which is like fine, he should do that if that's what
even
he
when she's there though, and he's sees her across the barrier. That's what's peculiar about it. Like, he's hugging her and he's still calling her on a flip phone. So I'm wondering, you know, what's actually going on.
But he's just kind of in his own little world, and you know, he strikes me as a really, really, really serious competitor, like attacking people on downhills. Yeah. In wet races when he doesn't need to be. Like, that's a guy who wants to win and wants to win big. But I don't think he's racing any harder against people than Tadej Pogačar. And that takes us to our next topic. Volta Catalunya this week. Stage race in Catalunya. Supposed to be a good race. Tadej Pogačar is stomping people at this race. If they're his friends, they must be his best friends because he's racing that hard against them. There's been three stages. Pogačar almost won the sprint finish on stage one, should have won the sprint finish, just mistimed it. Probably was so easy to him. You can see him looking around in the group thinking, is no one going to chase Nick Schultz down? What's the problem? What's going on? And then he's like, oh, they're tired. I should go after him. And then so he gets second the first day, wins the second day, wins the third day. And he's winning by like a minute, over a minute on stages. Like, he currently has a 2.5 minute lead over Mika Landa in the GC. After 3 days of racing, and most Grand Tours are won by less than that. So he is on form. He is dominating people at Volta Catalunya. Someone texted me right before we started recording, is it inappropriate that Tadej Pogačar is just beating up on second-rate guys at Catalunya? And it does look like that, but we have to remember the reigning Vuelta España champion is here, Sep Kuss. He's in seventh, 3.5 minutes behind. And Geraint Thomas is here, who got second at the Giro last year. He's 8 minutes behind. So it's not
I had no idea Thomas was there. Watching the race all week. Wow. Slow build.
Must
be doing these stages fasted. That'd be mine. Yeah.
I saw him off the back today and I was like, man, that guy's not in shape. And then I myself was off the back on a climbing race today thinking, you know, it's just a slow build. We're slow building towards the summer, me and Geraint. We'll make it there.
Yeah, there's no off season in Boulder. We can be certain of that. The thing that's really jumped out at me at Catalunya, because Pog's dominance has been total, is it just me, or is the quality of roads in these races much worse than in previous years? And I don't know if that's because it's heating up and cooling off more due to global warming, or like what's going on, but these roads seem like total garbage, way worse than I feel like I've ever seen them race on.
They are worse than previous years. And actually in Boulder, our roads are worse than I feel like they've ever been. I do think one of the reasons why is freeze thaw, just more extreme weather does chew the roads up a lot, especially heavy rains. You wouldn't think like rains would be that bad for a road, but it basically creates little sinkholes under the road, gate cave, you get massive potholes. I'm noticing the same thing in every race in Italy and Spain. Spain usually has very good roads. I guess some of this is maybe in Andorra. I do think they're known for having good roads too. So I do think the climate could have something to do with it. Probably also has to do with just lower municipal budgets, both in the US and in Europe. I mean, how are the roads in Maine? Do you guys is that just the GDP of the whole state goes into the roads?
Yeah, part of what's amazing about Midcoast Maine is that they just repave every road every year, which has got to be great for whoever's in the asphalt business here.
Yeah, it's like standing with Maui. They just pave the road every 5 weeks, it feels like.
Yeah.
So something's going on here.
Yeah, and they don't tear up the old road. I'm curious over time, like what happens and when they eventually do a full resurfacing. But for the most part, they just pave over whatever's there, and then you get the same sinkholes and, you know, what have you. I am surprised to hear about the quality of the roads in Boulder, because I guess I'm being a bit presumptuous, but I assume that they were probably LEED certified and grass-fed, cruelty-free roads that don't suffer from the force of nature. But it sounds like they're in fact pretty bad right now.
I'd say quite bad. I mean, to the point where a lot of times you want to ride a gravel bike on the road because you're just, there's so many potholes and stuff. There's clearly something complicated going on. It seems like the city roads are quite bad, roads under the city's authority. And then there's like county roads that are much nicer. Like Peak to Peak Highway is a big road for triathletes that's perfect all the time. So I don't know what's going on. We don't want to break down the budget differences between Boulder City and Boulder County. But other notes from Catalunya, that just things I found interesting. Mika Landa, pretty good. He gets a lot of crap. The guy's in second. It looks like he's getting stomped, womped, but he's almost 30 seconds ahead of Alexander Vlasov on Bora, who also looks good. Lenny Martinez looks good. And here's my little own. Maybe I'm like obsessing over this too much, but Vlasov looks great. Kain Uttabrooks, who left Bora because he called the team basically unprofessional idiots who didn't know what they were doing, left to go to Visma, significantly worse than he was when he was at Bora. He is he's 2 minutes behind Vlasov right now. The guy he left because he was mad the team wouldn't make Vlasov support him in his quest to get seventh place at the Vuelta a España. I do think this, I'm circling this, is this could be the disaster transfer of the year, especially with how contentious it was. It was a force. He just left Bora, called them a bunch of idiots to join a new team. If he is not good at Visma, that's not a good look for him at all.
Yeah, certainly. A few other notes on the GC here. Like when I was watching Landa today, and as you noted, he's looking better than some other pretty heavy hitters. Just the way he looked on the bike though today did not look good to me. I mean,
he hasn't looked good on the bike for like 5 years. I don't know what's going on.
Yeah, but I mean, what was his cadence? Like 60?
Old baby. Yeah. Me and Landa riding 60 RPMs.
Yeah. Yeah. So, and then I just kept thinking about, you know, this is, what is it like to be him? You're in a shorter stage race. You're not going to win a stage. You're not going to win the race. And then you're going to go ride for Remco. So like, what, do you know what I mean? So it's like, is this just like your warm up for going into that domestique role for the rest of the season? So how does that potentially?
Hold on. Pump the brakes there. So first of all, he's doing the Vuelta. So I'm sure for him, it's all building towards Vuelta. But if you're Mikel Landa, you're looking pretty good. Let's say you get second at Catalunya behind Pogacar. In my opinion, that's as good as a win. You go to the tour, I guess, to work, ostensibly to work for Remco. Remco is, look, what have we learned? Just using our eyes to read and our eyes to watch the race, there's a good chance Remco poops out at that race and just, oh, in a mountain stage, I got dropped 5 minutes into the first climb and I lost 50 minutes. And then Mika Landa is sitting there as a team's only GC option. I'm sure that's in the back of his mind.
Fair. Yeah, that's fair. You're absolutely right. Remco will have some kind of temper tantrum situation, and then it'll turn into Remco's going to go for a stage win.
Yeah. Oh my God, he's such a good stage winner. He is. The guy's a great stage hunter, but let's stop talking about him as though he's a serious GC candidate. He's never climbed good in high Alps. It's never happened. So until I see that, I'm not convinced he is a serious tour contender, and I'm sure that hasn't gone unnoticed by Mika Landa.
Yeah. Another thing that jumped out at me today was just the sight of Quintana, you know.
Oh, man, I forgot he was here, actually.
Way off the back of the action. I mean, it was a classic race coverage move where when the Pog attack went, we, of course, were looking at the back of some group, and then you cut back to the front. It's like, oh, he's 10 seconds up the road. But yeah, they gave us some great footage.
I don't think we've seen a single Pogacar attack at this race. Just like, where are these moves happening?
Yeah, it's uncanny. Oh, I will note that Quintana, though, does sit ahead of Geraint Thomas. He's 45 seconds out of Thomas, it looks like. So that's not bad. But not, you know, I mean, Nairo is pretty much done. He's just out there riding around, unfortunately.
Yeah. And I mean, I did hear that he stayed very fit last year. For those who don't know, he raced in 2022.
Yeah.
Little shadow doping ban, perhaps, in 23. Didn't race on a team in 24. Especially at his age, I don't think you can take a year off. I think it's too hard. Even if you try to train as hard as you can, like once you step off that treadmill, it's really hard to get back on.
Yeah. And we see Bernal currently 15th on GC, 138 down. I mean, are we going to run into yet another messy Ineos let the road decide power struggle? Is that like where we're headed in the next 2 months?
He's right behind Bernal. Lawrence De Plus on Ineos. I mean, these guys, like I think De Plus got like ninth at the Giro last year. It's like you have a guy who could win this race and they're all just clustering in the top 10. You're going to see like four Ineos riders finish in the top 10 of the tour, and none of them at any point will help each other during the race. That's exactly what's going to happen.
Right. And in this moment, I had spaced out. We, of course, have GC Pidcock coming down the pipe here.
But you know what's really interesting about that? He said he's racing GC because in that team, you cannot say, I'm just going for stages because there's so many people going for GC. If you're not going for GC, you have to work for the GC riders.
Ah.
So all those guys say, I'm going for GC, so they don't have to work for another person. Because he said, if he's not going for GC, he's not going to have the opportunity to win stages. So he's only going for GC to try to win stages for himself. It's really a mess. Like, that's a mess. Something has gone wrong if you have that happening in your team.
Yeah, that's pretty wild. I hadn't thought about it like that. I am feeling like Little Trek looking a lot better than previous seasons far, right?
A lot better. And then they have more money because they have Little on board, which if you're not, Little is that company is a giant of grocery. Holy smokes. But they're significantly better. I mean, they got Jonathan Milan from Bahrain. That reminds me, Antonio Tiberi, who killed a cat on purpose and got kicked off Trek last year, got picked up by Bahrain and is really good now, like one of the best riders at Catalunya behind Pogacar. Just an odd wrinkle there. Very conflicted. You're watching someone ride very well and you're like, this person kind of stinks. Why are they here? But Matt, that takes us to our last little segment before we go. E3 coming up on Friday. Really strange. I think this catches people off guard. E3 on Friday, Gent-Wevelgem on Sunday. So you have like a major classic on a weekday, which for people who live outside of Belgium is not observed as a holiday. Gent-Wevelgem is technically the bigger race. It's longer. It's 250K. E3 is kind of a mini Tour of Flanders. Like, I think more riders use this as a Flanders tune-up than Gent-Wevelgem, just because the course is a little bit more similar. It's just like a mini Tour Flanders. And Mads Pedersen, I could see him winning that race. And we've got the big boys are here. You have Van Aert, you have Vanderpoel, you have Mateo Jorgensen, Arno Dali. I'm curious to see how he does now that he's hopefully recovered from his injury that he picked up at, I forget, some stage race. But Pedersen could win E3. I mean, Pedersen could win Tour of Flanders. Like, it's not out of the question.
Yeah.
Like, Little Trek is the lurking giant here.
Yeah. And Pedersen had a really hot hand at the beginning of the season. And then we saw him lose a few stages that seemed tailor-made for his abilities, like the slight uphill sprint. We saw him lose a couple of times. But yeah, I agree with you. I think he's going to come out strong, strong probability of winning. And I'm just like looking through.
Yeah, you're right. He lost two stages at Paris-Nice. He probably should have won. And then at San Remo, I kind of thought the whole thing was going towards Mads Pedersen winning. You know, he looked like he was in perfect position. And then he just was tired. He was tired. Go figure. After 6 hours at 29 miles an hour, pretty tired.
Yeah. And I am curious to see how going back to Vanderpoel being really comfortable with his teammate winning at Milan San Remo. I'm wondering, you know, based on what we saw at Paris-Roubaix last year, are we potentially going to see a situation where Philipsen wins one of the cobbled classes?
I think I like Philipsen a lot for Sunday.
Yeah.
Bubblegum.
Yeah.
And I guess, now you mentioned that, you jog my memory. That explains, that partially explains why he was so all in for Philipsen, because in theory, he should have been working for Philipsen at Roubaix, because it didn't make a ton of sense. Like, let's say Wout doesn't flat, so he goes to the line with Wout and drops his own teammate who would win that sprint against Wout, and he might lose against Wout. didn't really add up. He got lucky that there was a flat tire. But I think, yeah, they get to Flanders, they get to Roubaix. It's like, okay, Jasper, let's go to the back seat. It's Vanderpool time. So he's trying to buy goodwill, basically.
And this is also the period last year when we had to think through all of the potential Visma drama that was going to happen, directly analogous to what we discussed, where Van Aert was having to set up his teammates so that he could get support later in the Cobbled Classics. But, you know, I don't anticipate anything happening in that regard. I don't think we're going to see anyone be conflicted about helping Wout do what Wout does this year.
No, and that didn't work very well. Obviously, they won E3. That was awesome. But they got to those bigger races and they just, I don't know. I don't want to say they were too cute, but they also won Gent-Wevelgem. I mean, talk about a good weekend. You went E3 on Friday, Gent-Wevelgem on Sunday. And they kind of, I don't know, it just didn't look as sharp at Flanders or Roubaix, even though, you know, Wout just got straight up dropped at Flanders and then Roubaix flatted, but he was kind of isolated. And that just, I don't know, I think they're going to be more focused this year as opposed to doing this, like, we all could win. Like, let's, even though at Omloop, they were clearly trying to launch Jorgensen to the win to take pressure off the rest of the team. Like, we could see something like that at E3 or Gent-Wevelgem, but that will just be if you're strong enough to be in that group and you're not Wout, obviously it's better for you to attack because who's going to chase you and pull Wout up to you?
Right. And if Wout doesn't win Flanders or Roubaix this year, does it start to be concerning if you're Wout?
Yeah. I mean, you've heard every side of this argument. Like, you know, I guess I've heard the argument of like, no, it doesn't matter because he's so good. What does he care? I bet he cares. And you know, they care in Belgium. Like, this is a big topic of conversation. You know, if he doesn't win one of those, I don't say this lightly, but it's kind of a disaster. Like, things start to get uncomfortable for him, I think, at home, because he's 29 years old and he should have won one of those races by now. And this is the year that it has to happen.
Yeah. If he doesn't this year, I think we might see him permanently relocate to Andorra or Monaco.
You do see this happen. You're like,
right?
Like, Boonen was having a hard time. He wasn't winning as much and he left Belgium.
It could happen. So, especially with his GC ambitions, we might not see him be in prime classics condition. Although I'm sure he's trying hard.
I mean, I do kind of wonder about the weight at Roubaix. He has to be a little bit lighter, but I think that could help him at Flanders because it is turning into such a hard race. If he, let's say he is trying to win GC at the Giro, I don't know if that's true, but I do tend to think he will try. I think that could help him at Tour Flanders. If he wins Flanders, he's got a pass for the rest. He doesn't have to win another race for the rest of the year.
Yeah, totally. And we'll get into it in a future episode. I think both of those races, we're going to see the long range bombs being dropped again.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
And I think, I mean, that's what's so nice about San Remo. You can't do the long range bomb because the course just isn't hard enough to do it. People are going to follow you. I think what you're seeing is these really, really strong guys are just thinking, so if I sit around, I'm increasing the variables between me and a win because people can, I'm going to wait till 10K to go and there's going to be a bunch of guys with me. What if I flat? What if I crash? If I just attack from 90K out, like think back to our Pogacar numbers conversation, he attacks from 90K out at Strada. He's alone for what, about 2 hours? His power output probably wasn't that much different than a training day, you know? It just, I'll ride 360. I'll ride 360 watts for 2 hours and no one can catch me. If I crash, I have time to get back on the bike. I'm fine. If I flat, I'm fine. So why wouldn't you attack from that far out, especially if it's just following your training plan? So I think you're going to see guys going from really far out at Roubaix and Flanders.
Do you think Hirschi has a chance at E3?
No. In theory, yes. In practice, no. Something's going on with Mark Hirschi at major races where he's not very good. He's unbelievable at dot pro races. And then he gets the World Tour races and he just is not the same person. I don't know what's going on.
Yeah, I don't know either.
Let me look this up. The last World Tour race he won was in the year 2020. And he's won 13 races since then, all in the division below the World Tour or the one below that. So I don't know if that's a positioning issue or what's going on there.
Well, the road will decide, Spencer.
The road will, we'll let the road decide. Actually, we'll bill Ineos for that advice.
Yeah, and we don't know if it's going to be climate proof. It may have a lot of cracks in it, that road that decides this race.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, the road will decide. It will swallow up one of our riders in a pothole, and that will be, they will not be the leader anymore. But thanks, Andrew, and I'm excited for Friday. I think that's, if you know, if you're listening to this and you don't have time to watch Catalunya, you don't have time to watch Bruges de Panne today, which Jasper Philipsen won over Tim Merlier. Go figure. Jasper Philipsen, best sprinter in the world. Get used to it, people. It's a fact. But if you don't have time for all that, make time for E3 on Friday. That's going to be a good one. I believe on Max, but don't quote me on that. It is an independent race. It is not part of Flanders Classic, so it's not on Flow Bikes.
Yeah, and if you're on the fence about which service to get, I just want to give you a heads up that Flow blocks you from streaming from your phone onto your TV. So if you're running through a VPN, so just something to keep
sometimes,
in mind.
Sometimes it does not. I've not figured out which one, why. Why does it sometimes block me from doing that? Other times, why does it not block me? Now, and that's, yeah, when you're using a VPN. If you're not using a VPN, it's totally fine.
Yeah. On the other hand, if you want to discover completely unrelated sports you didn't know exist that take place in high school gymnasiums, Flow Sports is for you. They've got it.
They've got a lot on there. A lot on there. Well, thanks, Andrew. And we will talk. We'll talk next week after E3 in Ghent and before Flanders. It's a beautiful time of year. I would love to be in Belgium for this. Maybe next year we'll try to do that.
Live
at the finish of Flanders as they're finishing.
Yeah, we'll actually be there to hug each rider.
People are seething. I can't believe it. These podcast hosts, it's gotten out of control. They're hugging each other.
They're just there. They're hugging everybody. They're just, can you believe it?
All right. Well, thanks so much and talk to you later.